From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Many, many years ago, there were only two Batman movies. Actually, three Batman movies. But only two real proper Warner Brothers ones. But anyway, Todd McFarlane was the lead artist on Spider-Man in the late 80s. And he famously was one of the first people, well, one of many people, but the first people of the new school to enunciate clearly, fuck Marvel. And he did this by, along with Eric Larson and Rob Liefeld, he founded Image Comics. And Image Comics had two titles, actually three titles, four titles. Wildcats, Brigade, Youngblood, and Spawn. Spawn, because Tom McFarlane is a genius in the sense that he understands what he's doing is he's designing toys for people around the ages of 6 to 43. And Tom McFarlane was famous for inventing Venom in every way, in drawing, conception, the idea of a symbiote. The idea of calling your costume a symbiote is a strictly McFarlanean nomenclature. Anyway, Spawn wears a costume exactly like Venom, mostly. His costume is also called a symbiote. Because Spawn, Tom McFarlane is consistent. So anyway, it's 1992, Signal Hills Mall. I'm already aware of Spawn because I go to Shinjo's and buy comics. It's already a ritual. Because comics and toys are ritual. But this is 94, and Spawn only existed in paper. And in 94, what we had was the debut of McFarlane Toys and the Spawn toy line, which became the McFarlane empire that persists to this day. The first five issues of Spawn are really kind of derivative of The Crow and Batman. And imagine, if you will, a more violent Ninja Turtles. It's that everything you see in the 15 issues of Spawn is nothing more than an introduction of a toy, an accessory to a toy, and an action figure line. The thing that gets really bad with the first 15 issues of Spawn, and you won't see them collected in collected editions, is Todd McFarlane didn't write all of Spawn. He didn't really write too much of Spawn. He'd write some issues and delegate things to other creatives. And as a result of this, Spawn's main female foil is a Catwoman to his Batwoman. Batwoman. I'm going full Amber Rose here. Catwoman to his Batman, and that is Angela. And Angela is the legal property of Neil Gaiman and is no longer allowed to be used in Spawn comics. So if you're interested really peaked in Spawn and you were to go ordering shit from Amazon, you'd have to buy the more expensive trade paperbacks with Angela. But the good news about Angela is that the most expensive Angela comic is only $10 anyway. So if one were so inclined, you could really have a complete run of Spawn for under $2,000, which is a wonderful investment, and I recommend it to everyone. I mean, there are only three. And number one is between $10 and $12, sometimes $30. 2 weeks ago it was $35. That was I think an error. But Spawn legitimized the idea that there weren't just two comic companies, and it chugged along through the 90s until Marvel recaptured everything with their 9/11 Heroes tribute, and people forgot that Spawn and Image Comics even existed until The Walking Dead was published.
That's true. They kind of just D.B. Coopered Image Comics like right after 9/11.
Yeah, because when I think of the 90s comics, I really think of the images from Image Comics. The Rob Liefeld, the Todd McFarlane stuff. Even Todd McFarlane, his run on Spider-Man. You know, that is that him and Liefeld, to me, epitomize what comics looked like in the 90s. And it all crystallized over at Image. When I was a kid, Spawn was the edgy comic you had to have your parents get for you because you couldn't buy. You had to be 18 and old to buy it. Yeah, I had like a friend down the street. His mom would buy him Spawn comics, so I'd read them over there at his house because I wasn't allowed to read that, you know. But you know, and I had a friend who had the Super Nintendo Spawn game, which was total garbage, but you know, it seemed cool at the time.
The merchandising ethos of the brand.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting what you said about McFarlane draws everything with a toy in mind. Because I've read that initial run of Spawn, and it does kind of feel like when the characters are introduced, you're seeing them as something to purchase.
Without question. Yes, there's unfortunately, of all the characters in the first 12 to 15 issues of Spawn, everybody but Billy Kincaid and Jason Wynn and Anthony Twist are not in action figure form. I mean, everyone else is a toy, and a lot of them don't even matter. Like Overt Kill is a completely worthless throwaway character.
Well, if they make a Jason Wynn toy, it needs to be in the guise of Martin Sheen.
Well, thankfully, they did that 5 years later. I'm only speaking with, you know, the child's eye view of or in the small KB Toys and wondering why the Spawn line was not as comprehensive as the Batman the Animated Series line, even though these are supposed to be ultra action figures. Mm.
I remember when I was in high school, Todd McFarlane his toys would pick up other brands like Trigun or like Akira. Like I still have some of the McFarlane toys of Akira. I have a Tetsuo figure somewhere in my closet that he made in an Akira.
The anime market in the 2000s when they still had CM Goody.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that you can't like see action figures in stores, really. They only make Walking Dead and Batman stuff, which is ironic.
Interesting.
But also, I forget that Spawn is ever present in Tom McFarlane's toy line.
So is Spawn still a thing in comics?
Yes, but only in the way that people consume and patronize it as a protest act. I don't think anyone would ever say that Spawn currently is good, or that they're excited about the next Spawn, or that anything going on in Spawn will ever be of any cultural importance ever again.
Spawn just seems like a 90s thing that came with the culture with stuff like Doom, The Crow, stuff like that. Like, you know, he's a character who's out of hell. You know, this was when everything was like demons from hell. Like,
yeah, everything is goth. Everything is demons from hell. Everything is drawn to a New Order or Sisters of Mercy CD.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you had a lot of clowns. The Violator was definitely an eye-catching villain.
And without not to just say eye catching, but ICP.
Yes,
juggalism
Yeah, it's foreign with juggaloism. I kind of saw the Spawn comics back when, I remember when all that stuff hit big, and like all those Image artists were like millionaires overnight, I think, when all that stuff dropped. To me, it felt like a backlash to, in the 80s, DC and Marvel pushed, well, mainly DC pushed a lot of writer-focused titles. You know, it's written by Alan Moore, it's written by like Neil Gaiman or whoever. And they were really pushing like the writer over the artist. And it felt like Spawn was sort of a backlash against that. Because I don't think any of the writer-oriented stuff sold as well to the actual comic book market. You know, yeah. Where, you know, it's like the Spawn thing was like a backlash. Like, look, here's a comic book with cool art with the guy who made Spider-Man look cool and updated Mary Jane's look, you know, all these years later, where everybody was still drawing the John Romita flower girl Mary Jane or whatever.
He contemporized the look, and Bagley and everyone copied his work. Not copied, they just, they codified it by continuing the style as if it was the inherited style guide.
Right, because it was like, when I was a kid, like at peak Marvel zombie level in the late 70s, it was kind of writer-artist combos. Doug Minch and Paul Gulacy are on Master of Kung Fu, and you know, Frank Miller and is on Daredevil with whoever was writing it, and then Frank took over. But you know, Doug Minch and Bill Sienkiewicz or Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams. But then it was almost like it couldn't be one or the other. It had to be like the writer or the artist. And then the artist basically won when Image Comics formed.
Yeah, and I'm gonna kind of be mean about Vertigo. But you know, nobody cares. I mean, really, people like academics.
Yeah.
But nobody cares. Like, I've never...
Vertigo was for people who bought Cure remixes, I think.
Yeah, I've never read Sandman. I don't care about it. I've spent quite a lot of time in Menominee at you know, who's commune. I think he's a cool guy. I've been... The threat of me being forced to organize his CD collection or library has been levied against me by my legal representatives on occasion. Because that means that I'll be the lowest possible man on the Yiddish totem pole. I respect the hustle, but yeah, I don't give a shit about Sandman. I don't give a shit about Neverwhere.
I never liked Neil Gaiman that much. I don't know. Just Sandman was something I never felt particularly drawn to.
Sandman, Neil Gaiman's greatest. Is the hustle. He is the product. The idea is, buy my thing, love me, witness my frail weakness. You know, it's a trick he learned. It's a trick we all learned from Woody Allen. He just does it with an accent.
Yeah.
Which, you know, goes.
Yeah, it's the same thing Harlan Ellison tried to pull, and of course Neil Gaiman was good friends with Harlan Ellison, and it was more about, hey, I wear a black T-shirt, I wear sunglasses indoors.
Yeah, that seemed to be a thing in the '90s. Was like people like Neil Gaiman, where it was they created this. I knew who he was, I knew his name, and I had never read or looked at anything he did, but he just was so aggressive about pumping his brand out there.
He
marketed himself over the content, really.
It's exactly what you have to do, because people who read and have jobs and multiple homes will look at you and tell you that Sandman was important and good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This is so brave. So such great, unique stuff.
Yeah, Batman's not in it. Nobody cares.
Yeah. And when you read it, it was just EC Comics with these gods kind of orchestrating stuff. So it was kind of lifted from the 70s Spectre comics that Mike Fleischer wrote, which were actually really great. It had all that complex fantasy stuff. Like, he threw in a bunch of pseudo Tolkien and Mervyn Peake type of things.
Yeah. And the demo just goes crazy for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, the future's only going to get brighter now that, you know, Clive Barker has been memory hold of society by Comcast.
Right.
So, you know, it's, well, no, I think Neil Gaiman's great, and I would totally, totally organize his library and would not openly conflict with him over gynecological resources, assuming he respected me.
Well, I know he married that crazy, what's her name? Amanda.
Amanda Palmer.
Oh, yeah.
That does happen. It's like stepping on a Lego.
Yeah. Well, I remember when she was the living bride in Harvard Square. I used to walk through Harvard Square and I'd see her doing her living bride routine. I had no idea she'd become this pop star that married Neil Gaiman.
Didn't they get divorced recently?
Yeah, they got divorced last year. I think she split with him, like he was on a different continent or something. And like
it was during the lockdown. It was during the lockdown, right?
Yeah, like I think he had to read on the internet that she was divorcing him or something. It was crazy.
I'm sure that it was very like a conscientious decoupling or whatever. That one. And totally, totally good. Neil Gaiman is great and beloved by all women and all people of trust identities.
Well, she, I think she was getting a bad rap as sort of an egomaniac or something. I mean, real shocking with rock stars or pop singers, whatever the hell she is.
Well, I like to believe all women. I can't think objectively about these things.
Right.
I'm sure that this is somehow related to Wisconsin and all that somehow. This doesn't concern.
Right. He's
not the fault of Neil Gaiman and all his good works and his continued good works.
Right. But I know he, as soon as like he wrote this TV show, I think it was Neverwhere or something, and suddenly there was like an audience ready for that just because Neil Gaiman's name was on it. Like he was doing his first TV show, and then he's doing his first prose novel, so now this is gonna sell like crazy, you know, whatever it was called.
American Gods, or was it before that?
He did a novel, I think, with Terry Pratchett called Good Omens.
Oh, was Good Omens, it? Yeah, which just made into a TV show with David Tennant, yeah.
Right, I've never seen it. I don't watch it on TV shows.
Also, the only one that died too. So,
right,
like the better, he got the better half of the partnership.
Right, right. But yeah, he did ride that Clive Barker wave. And Zolly's right. Clive Barker's been totally memory holed. Is like, yeah, this guy brings the British horror thing over here.
Well, you know, because Clive Barker was this brand for a while. You know, he had video games like Jericho and.
Yeah,
you know, he was kind of like the edgier Stephen King, you know, the Stephen.
Well, he was sadomasochistic homosexual Stephen King.
Yeah, exactly. So. Like, you know, it's in his movies, like you'd see people get ripped apart with chains by crazy monsters, right, and stuff.
Yeah, bondage creatures.
Yeah, Scott Bakula is going to be watching crazy phantasmagorical shows and going, oh boy.
It was a strange quantum leap, that one was.
Yeah.
That was the problem with Lord of Illusion. Everybody thought they walked into a particularly dark episode of Quantum Leap on the big screen.
Yeah, man, this episode of Quantum Leap, I don't remember it. Where's Dean Stockwell?
Yeah, exactly. They were asking where he was. Where are we going to see him look in the mirror and he's somebody else? You know,
Clive Barker is like last ever real thing with Hollywood. And he was, well, I don't know, they like to say like the Weinsteins are too mean to him on Hellraiser 4 or something, but I think he got too sick or whatever.
Well, he did that movie with Ryuhei Kitamura recently, not recently, but like 10 years ago, like Midnight Meat Train.
Yeah.
That was the last, remember him doing.
It was like 2008, 2009, 2010.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And Hulu did Books of Blood. I haven't looked at it, but.
Yeah, that's true.
It is on Hulu. It's hard to see things on Hulu.
My guess is he may have disappointed people in the biz or something, or he did something stupid, or he fucked the wrong dude. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's because people have a. Yeah, only one thing can occupy one space at one time, and
right. You have to have the British dark fantasy writer, but you can't have a bunch of them.
You can have one.
So they cancel each other out.
And Alan Moore won't work with studios, so it's like Neil Gaiman will write whatever you pay him to write. So yeah, that's the guy. He's agreeable. Like he'll come on in and work with people. He'll collaborate. You know.
Now, that is the thing. There's a big argument to be said for, like, you know, Alan Moore should have taken the money and steered the plane to a crash.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that he had his Harlan Ellisonian limit.
And decided, right.
some point. You know, working in comics does do that to people.
Yeah, I imagine it would.
But once again, his best stuff involves Batman.
I think the last Spawn comic I ever read was a Batman and Spawn team up that maybe Frank Miller wrote and somebody ghost drew it for, you know, Todd McFarlane or something.
Both the Batman Spawn comics have rough art.
Yeah, and it's
professionally trained drawer of Mark David Chapman comics.
Right. Now, I think the only reason the movie was made was because probably Mike DeLuca got a lot of press as a comics loving movie executive. Yes. And so he was getting all these options on these dark cult things. And, you know, like he was trying to make a deal before he was fired. He's trying to make the first American deal with Takashi Miike, like back in 1997 or 98 when Fudo played the Toronto Film Festival. And like, he was already lining up a deal for Takashi Miike to do an American film. He's probably also the reason they imported Rummel in the Bronx. And, but then he was fired for various reasons and like 99 or so, and New Line kind of lost that edge. And then it became so mainstream with Lord of the Rings. But before that, they were doing stuff like Spawn that like would gross like 80 million at best or 90 million. And then that was it.
Well, the Spawn movie gets a lot of criticism, but once again, it's completely tonally accurate to the movie, to the comic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Everything that existed at the time. And the only real like tragedy is there weren't like 4 or 5 more Michael J. White Spawn movies of that or lesser quality.
Well, let me ask, because you know, Spawn came out in 1997, directed by Mark A.Z. Dippe, and it stars Michael High White, or Michael Jai White. I guess it's Jai White.
I always call it Michael Jai White. So I've heard some people call it Michael High White, so I don't know.
Yeah, I was watching the Blu-ray features, and people working on the movie were calling him Michael Jai White, so I assume they know. But he's a guy that, you know, I'm a big fan of. John's a big fan of. We like him, but he stars in this movie, but he never became a big action star. And I kind of wonder, I can't cast my mind back to Hollywood of 1997, but, you know, like Zali said, you can only get one thing. And I know in Hollywood, you can only have like one tough black guy in Hollywood at a time. I kind of wonder if maybe that's why he didn't have a bigger career. Because this film did pretty respectable business. It made like double its budget back. But we never got another one. Michael Jai White never went on to be a big action star. He's in a lot of direct-to-video stuff, and he's in some movies supporting cast. But this is the biggest break he's had, I think.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, I think the thing with Spawn is that New Line also did Blade, and people liked Blade better than
right.
Wesley Snipes. I mean, that's the elephant in the room, is they had the whole... I mean, Wesley Snipes is also a martial artist, kickboxing guy. He's also, you know, black and playing a superhero in a New Line movie produced by Mike DeLuca and Bob Shea. So, like, they were like, nobody likes Spawn. And at the time, Roger Ebert and all these, like, TV parents, people were very hot on Spawn.
Yeah.
Satanic gothic elements, which they ate up in the exact correct way. So it added an extra layer of scorn and derision towards a would-be Ninja Turtles franchise. For no real reason. But like, you know, to be mean. But it was good. I mean, it was good to be like, well, you know, maybe all this satanic Marilyn Manson shit could be bad for 8-year-old boys, but I don't think serious with those concerns. They were, you know, Roger Ebert didn't give a shit about anything. He didn't. He really didn't give a shit about it.
And like Blade, this was an R-rated comic book movie, But I think...
Was it R-rated? No. Yeah, I think it was PG-13.
When it came out, it was PG-13.
Yeah, oh, it was PG-13. Oh, okay.
The video is fake rated R because it's so extreme and satanic.
Yeah, like, because that's where I got that from was the Blu-ray case. It says R, rated R, but when you watch it, it doesn't seem like an R-rated film.
They save the dog at the end?
Yeah.
And faith in the family restored, and that is the finest Nicole Williams performance. It's better than Excalibur, because build on the Merlin look Excalibur, because like he's been there, right, and he got frozen and shit. Mm-hmm. He's training Spawn to be the next guy. It's really good. But I think another thing is you couldn't see Michael J. White's face.
I was about to say that Michael J. White is buried under makeup. Wesley Snipes was not in Blade.
That's a huge factor right there.
Yeah, and the full fact that like Spawn is, I don't mean to be harsh, like visually like repulsive.
Yeah, when I was watching this the other night on the Roku channel, which I don't know if that's a real remastered streaming print, because it just seemed a little off. I don't know if Hunter, if you had the same viewpoint. I'm sure Zolly has some.
I only watch the finest Blu-rays, sir. So.
Okay, you watch a Blu-ray. Zolly probably watched on 4K on some experimental 4K that hasn't been released yet. But boy, the aspect ratio just seemed weird. And
you're watching the PG-13 theatrical HD version then?
Okay, that's probably what it was then.
Ratio. So that's what a Spawn expert I am. The theatrical HD was made like 25 years ago when HD was just invented, and it's an aspect ratio and is actually like 540i and has like jagged. And the way
it was weird because it looked like HD 20 years ago on when people got their first HD TVs that were actually heavy and had a thick back on them and everything.
There's a Canadian Blu-ray that uses that exact transfer.
Okay.
90 seconds.
I have never seen the R cut. For whatever its value is.
I you know, it's a tactical secret. I can't. It's too much heat.
But that's what they're doing on the Roku channel. Just as a warning for any listeners thinking of checking it out on there.
Well, Spawn theatrical cut is the version we all fell in love with theatrically. So you got to experience both versions, but there's only one real difference between the two, and only Spawn experts can tell. And that's at some point, like Martin Sheen is like, "See you later, Al," when he kills him, but he's like, "D in hell, Al," because it's rated R.
Okay.
That's the difference.
I was thinking Melinda Clark would have had a like a nip slip or something.
Yeah, that would have that would have upset the Walmart moms. They even though it was like in satanic and Nine Inch Nails and shit, they still want to not upset the Walmart moms and have like.
Right. And I should note to listeners, this movie did come out before Columbine, before Marilyn Manson was considered this great threat to the country or whatever. Well, he was getting the protests and stuff, I think, in 96.
Yeah, he was controversial.
You know? The knives were out for that type of music and everything, you know.
I gotta tell you, I watched the music video for Can't You Trip Like I Do by the Crystal Method and Filter after watching this movie.
Yeah.
Watching Robert Patrick's brother sit in a room full of TVs.
That's the most 90s thing possible.
Oh, it's the most 90s music video. And it's got clips of Spawn peppered in there. It's perfect. I love it.
That is exactly the experience of being exposed to Image Comics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. I mean, when I think 90s, Image Comics, Filter, X-Files, that's about it, really.
Yeah. I think Filter being on X-Files just prepared us for Agent Doggett, you know?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I had no quarrels with the Agent Doggett or the Filter Giovanni Ribisi episode of X-Files.
Because we're going to be we're going to be covering some of the Agent Doggett episodes of the X-Files in future installments. So they return to our much X-Files format.
Yeah, absolutely.
You guys saw the news today, right?
What? What news?
They're going to make more X-Files.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. Oh, no.
It was heavily implied today on the internet that there was going to be more X-Files because the show that Gillian Anderson was on is not on anymore. And she needs a new one. And people don't like change.
Right.
So more X-Files.
And Fox needs that franchise. They can't bring back 24 for whatever reason. So X-Files the other one they can exploit.
We just can't have Jack Bauer anymore. I don't know why. I actually liked the Corey Hawkins fake 24 from 3 years ago. No, I didn't actually like it. I watched it. All of it. I wish they would make more for the purpose.
But I forgot it existed until you mentioned it.
It wasn't any. It was like really bad. It was very bad. It was a bad time for Jimmy Smith, I think, too. It was a low moment. Because it's like an English remake of the Hindi scene of 24 in English again. That may be too weird for the audience, but there's an Indian remake of 24. The 24th Corey Hawkins is an American remake of the Indian remake of 24. Mm. That is something you can only have in 20. That was.
That's like.
That's well, there like. There was a telenovela's remake of Breaking Bad that I actually wanted to watch.
Yeah, there was. This is the dharma of cinema, you guys. Like, we're going to remake the foreign remake of our film.
Back into English again. Yeah. It's recursive, great communicative art.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's what happens when they, like New Line Cinema bought the remake rights to Ringo Lam's Full Contact, which is hilarious because Full Contact is basically a ripoff of Point Blank, the John Borman movie.
Yes.
It's the same damn story. You know, it's just like, it's crazy. Like they don't read enough or see enough to even think that, oh, you don't even have to buy the remake rights to that, you know, or you get sued by Donald Westlake.
Yeah. The IP trolling thing isn't based on self-awareness, rationalness or anything. It's just like,
or literacy.
The illiteracy.
Well, there was that reminds me, there was a great story out one time that Todd McFarlane was developing a TV show called Gorilla World, and it was a complete plagiarism of Planet of the Apes. And Fox straight out cease and desist them before they could get that going. I think they were going to do it for UPN. And like they got lawsuits slapped so fast or cease and desist that they stopped. But somebody said, you know, all they had to do is go back and find this 1950s novel that Pierre Boulle plagiarized for Planet of the Apes that involved a world of talking, thinking gorillas and humans getting stuck in it. And they would have been able to go ahead with the show, but because nobody knows old work like that, they could have easily had a countersuit.
Yeah, they don't have awareness of the canon and maybe too much shame, probably.
Yeah. I would have loved that, a Todd McFarlane TV show called Gorilla World.
I mean, a lot of the mistakes that McFarlane and Rob Liefeld make with respect to their business decisions are like Trumpian like threats.
Yeah.
Don't like Rob Liefeld will get hired by DC Comics and then denounce them.
Like, yeah.
Later. And
didn't he pitch the idea, Zolly, that they should just cancel all their titles and do like a manga, like a thick manga phone book thing every month for like $10 and everybody could keep up with the stories and characters?
Yes, that's actually a prevailing desire amongst creators and dealers in the industry because people don't like arranging shit.
Right.
And most of the comics that aren't Batman or Spider-Man have to be returned or turned into dollar comics.
Right, right.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's not going to be a problem going forward for most comic stores because they will not be operating.
Right. So this could be the time to do it. This would actually be a good time to do it.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that Rob Liefeld does is that it's great about all the times. Whenever he's hired to do something like G.I. Joe, he will change it into Deadpool. Into Deadpool and Shatterstar and Cable. So he's never not making X-Force. The reason why I bring up Rob Liefeld is because Rob Liefeld is the American Todd McFarlane. Because we can't really without discussing his dirty secret, which is that he's not one of us.
Yeah, he's Canadian. Like, a lot of people don't realize that. He's a very Canadian comic book talent.
I mean, when I think of great Americans, like, when I wake up, like, I think of Todd McFarlane, but then, like, no.
No.
He's not. Yeah, he's in the Great White North. Yeah.
Yeah, he's over to there.
Rob Liefeld's also a big proponent of the Snyderverse, restoring the greatness, you know, bringing back cinema.
It's the only way to fix and or destroy DC Comics.
Either outcome is desirable.
Yes. It's what Batman would want.
Specifically Frank Miller's Batman.
Yes, Frank Miller's Batman has been full Snyder since...
Yes.
There was only one Dawn of the Dead movie, and Frank Miller was probably pro-Snyder already back then. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure if Zack Snyder existed before Frank Miller did. I mean, really. Maybe he might be like a thought-form agent conjured from his mind to... His dreams into celluloid in ways that Frank Miller could not, because I have no criticisms with RoboCop 2, but he does, and that is a personal battle which I think has scarred and changed him into a bitter man.
Yeah, well, I think it's because Waylon Green like rewrote the script so much. Although Frank Miller was on the set because he has that weird cameo in RoboCop 2.
I mean, RoboCop 2 is the greatest RoboCop sequel.
And
the finest movie Frank Miller ever wrote himself.
Yeah.
That was not a comic first. That he made. Yeah. Well, I mean, everything else is, I mean, the spirit is really kind of his spirit. But that's another thing. No, what matters is Todd McFarlane and Rob Liefeld are sort of the high mullahs of comicdom. They inhabit the position that Lee and Kirby did when they were alive and somewhat functioning in the commercial space. And that is they offer a scornful condemnation of all the horrible new things that are going on. And a return to selfishness, traditionalism, and the worship of the right and proper superheroes and toy lines, as opposed to ones that, were made 9 years ago.
Yeah, when I started following Rob Liefeld on Twitter, I went, oh, this is a comic guy who I like, which I hate most of them. I went and as I think of him as being trapped in the 90s, but when I see him on Twitter, the typical bug men come at him and tell him he can't draw feet or whatever, and he's just like, I just sold this picture for $1,000.
Exactly. Yes, he's going to NFT the shit out of that too.
Yeah, I know.
He's going to be like, I invented a new character. It's called Redpool. He's a great American innovator.
Truly.
Too bad, you know, Marvel Comics doesn't embrace Liefeld. Because, I mean, people, with the exception of the two characters, people will go out of their way to buy things by McFarlane and Liefeld. They just rarely, you know, do anything reliably. I mean, Spawn always comes out. Whatever titles Rob Liefeld is working on do come out. But Rob Liefeld, you know, he, as I've said, he'll depart and do something else. There's no concrete perpetual avenue of access aside from their social media. And the work they do isn't really representative of the messages they try to send or what they're even really about. It's all sort of like assembly line sandwich making.
Like making fun of Rob Liefeld's art has been it's sort of this Bugman thing to do on the internet. But I look at a lot of the stuff that Marvel and DC put out lately, and it's completely unappealing aesthetically. Like there was Liefeld, like say what you will about his artwork, but it captured something in the zeitgeist. It captured something in that moment. And I look at the artwork today, you know, in Red Skull's like Jordan Peterson telling people to clean their room, and Captain America has to stop Jordan Peterson Red Skull from imposing his lobster mindset onto young incels. I don't understand, you know.
I have a feeling that that wasn't intended to be Jordan Peterson. It was intended to be Andrew England, but Disney. Because it was too inside Judaism for them. Because, I mean, there was actually a time where the Red Skull wore an Andrew England costume for like 4 years.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and like, you know, that, but whenever they change teams on a comic, people like forget what they were doing, and they make new parallels and new things. I mean, there was a whole like year of 5 years. The Joker looked just like Richard Spencer. He had Richard Spencer hair, and he wore a Richard Spencer white suit. And, like, you know, nobody mentioned it.
Shopped at Orvis, yeah.
Yeah, did he get as fat as Richard Spencer?
Well, they changed the Joker after Richard Spencer became Goron-sized.
Yeah, because I think they had, like, five Jokers at one point, which actually made sense if they had multiple Jokers.
Yeah, it was a good way to explain the unexplainable.
Right, because they're very inconsistent with Joker portrayals. I actually thought that was a good idea. I heard they blew it, but I don't read current comics, so except for French stuff.
Very smart. Not reading current comics and reading current comics gives you just as much of a feel for current storyline trajectory.
Yeah.
There was an attempt by Geoff Johns to reconcile the Joker problem, but there were several competing Joker tie-in comics that weren't related at the same time, so no one was really sure what was what. And, I mean, the thing sold pretty good, but at the end of the day, Geoff Johns, when he worked on that title, fired anyway. Or let go as the company.
Right.
I thought it was a wholesome Batman comic, the ending at least. But, you know, nobody cares. It was completely forgettable. By all means, the hardcover.
The Spawn movie, though, kind of bringing it back to the film. This movie is extremely heavy on practical effects, but also CGI. And
new tech.
Yeah, it was. And at the time, I remember thinking it looked eye-popping when it came out. You know, you saw the trailer. And you
yeah.
You see the Violator, and you see Malbolgia, and hell, and, like, these fire pillars, and you're just like, whoa, you know. Now it's, like, something that, you know, when you see YouTube videos about it, they mock the CGI. But at the time, it was really cutting edge. And to me, like, speaking of Zack Snyder, one thing Zack Snyder did for Batman that made Batman less of just a stiff thing on the screen was giving him a CGI cape. And
yeah, cape is wonderful.
Yeah, and like the thing about the McFarlane comics, one of those things that was so 90s, you know, you said prizing art over story, you know, Spawn would always have this cape that just flowed out like into the night, you know, just impractically humongous. And we get that with this big flowing CGI cape in these scenes. And, you know, it definitely is not as sophisticated as what Snyder did, but it was really kind of forward thinking, I think. You know, just it seemed to push kind of it reminded me of how eclectic and interesting cape shit could be back in the late 90s
when it wasn't trying to appeal to the mainstream so much. I think
it was trying all this stuff.
And it was still going at the same audience for like Mortal Kombat Annihilation and all that. It wasn't trying to court single women under 30.
Yeah. Who dyed their hair purple.
strictly boys with light up shoes.
Right.
Oh yeah. I was one of those boys with light up shoes.
Well, you gotta be cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's funny because when I saw this in the theater, I saw it at a suburban theater in Cincinnati. Back when they had all these big multiplexes built with like 20 screens each, and every screen was gigantic. And I was wondering, am I too old to see this? You know, it's funny because that's the marketing at the time. That was the way it seemed, you know?
It aims. I mean, it's Peter Cullen does the trailer. It's Eeyore Optimus Prime getting you ready for the thrill ride. It's for kids. Spawn was made for kids. Image Comics was intended for kids.
Yeah.
Comics are for kids. And, kids just don't want comics anymore because comics are currently the worst superhero delivery form that exists.
Yeah, it's all about movies, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, reading comics wasn't necessarily cool. My friends and I did, but, you know, it's not something you advertised at school necessarily.
Yeah, it was something like it's a guilty pleasure, something you don't want to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah. But when comic book movies came out, all the people who, you know, would have ostracized you for reading or watching comics started watching the films. But you know, you have the Zoomers kind of grew up on not the cape shit that from the 90s, but like the more Cadillac Marvel TM stuff, Marvel Studios, where they've grown up on this delivery system that is more homogenous, let's say.
The post-credit sequence.
Yes. It's all tied in. It's like a comic book in that, you know, Thor the Dark World feeds into you know, whatever movie came next that was not a Thor movie. You know, Guardian, you know, you might see like a reference to something that might be in Guardians or something. But you know, in the early, you know, proto cape shit, let's say, like Spawn, you know, these films were more self-contained, so you could kind of try more things, do more things. you could, you weren't beholden to all, to like a series Bible, let's say, like a TV show is.
Yeah, and there was no big corporate rules of accountability, conduct that were, you know, governing speech codes and ideological performative stuff.
Yeah,
within your thing, that wouldn't be for almost 15 more years. I mean, the first superhero movie to even be reflective of the changed world, and this is actually kind of a really unusual take, is the second X-Men movie, made in a post 9/11 world.
I think that's accurate, yeah.
And that's when you see the flag pins of the 9/11, and that's one of the first. I mean, that's where Kevin Feige comes from. The Bryan Singer X-Men movies, and made his way to the Spider-Man and circled the globe and ruined it all for everyone.
And, you know, the second X-Men movie also seemed more explicitly political socially, too. It tied the X-Men to homosexuality quite directly, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, That is what the X-Men people just say about the X-Men.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's this scene.
Oh, boy, they never shut up about it either.
Yeah, there's this scene where, it's the scene where, I think they go to Iceman's home, and...
Oh, yeah.
He kind of comes out to his parents, you know? And they're like, well, yeah. Can't you just stop being a mutant? It's like, you know, it was like a coming out scene. And to me, I was like, okay, this is explicitly tying the mutant thing to the homosexual experience.
Yeah. But the thing about the X-Men that really people don't realize is it's just Wolverine.
Oh, absolutely.
So the other X-Men, aside from Charles Xavier and Magneto, don't matter.
No, it's like Toad, you know, they're kind of disposable, you know.
They're all people that Wolverine must uplift and save with his traditional heroism.
Even, like, the team leader is Cyclops, and he's killed off-screen in X3. Like,
yeah, Cyclops sucks.
He's discarded.
And then he's saved in X-Men 5. He's brought back to life, and that is such a great redemptive post 9/11 movie. It's up there with the dog living in Dante's Peak. Because, like, in the comics and the culture on Marvel and X-Men, Cyclops is like the worst Ned Flanders.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, going off, what's his name? I forget Brett Ratner's name. I'm so on edge.
He's another guy who's disappeared completely. Doesn't seem to exist anymore.
Well, it's because of the Natasha Henstridge accusation.
Well, yeah, he got kind of softly Me Too'd.
I believe Natasha Henstridge. She, is in one complete Albert Pion movie, which means that she's a good sort.
Yes.
Brett Ratner.
I think I derailed what you were saying about him. I apologize.
Oh, the Brett Ratner X-Men movie where they kill Cyclops. I remember people laughing.
Yeah.
It's like, no clues about Cyclops. But then, like, after, like, X-Men 3 had, like, existed for, like, a decade, people became very negative about the killing of all the peripheral X-Men who are not Wolverine.
Yeah.
Didn't the Deadpool movies kind of overcorrect X-Men 3?
Yeah, I'm like, so militant that I'm, like, against the Deadpool movies. I don't think... that, like, the X-Men should be mocked in that way. It's gotta be, like, like serious. It's got to be like serious. And if it's a joke like Ryan Reynolds and Blade Trinity, then it's terrible. I mean, Blade Trinity is the fate of all media.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds into nothing.
Okay, where did we see that? Because we were talking about that on Facebook or Twitter or something, that like Blade Trinity was the first.
Oh, yeah, because it has Ryan Reynolds and it's Patton Oswalt.
Yeah, it's like really jokey. Wesley Snipes was famously grumpy making it. And it's because it was all just it was a comedy. It wasn't a Blade movie. It was a comedy.
It's the trope of the action hero has to, you know, adopt a baby, you know, a seeing eye dog and like a fleet of ducks and like, you know, make sure they can fucking become cheerleaders or some shit. It's like, you know, Junior, like he has to have new sidekicks. I mean, I was happy to see Blade 3 when it came out, and I've, you know, bought the video 55 times.
Yeah, same.
It is a, it's a lawnmower through that shit, and it totally ruined that brand, and it's probably why New Line Cinema doesn't really even exist anymore, because they used to have franchises, and now they have nothing.
They really ran that studio into the ground after Lord of the Rings. You know, just bad decision after bad decision.
What has you thinking? Their success was always a fluke in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, they started out as like just releasing John Waters.
John Waters and Sonny Chiba movies, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have faith until it was too over. Until they remade Freddy and it was all gone. It's too bad. But, you know, at least, well, I won't sleep securely until all five House Party movies are on Blu-ray. Then
I didn't even realize there were five. I knew there were three.
Well, they made one in South Africa a few years
ago. Oh, okay.
Yeah, they really did.
Was that the pajama jammy apartheid jam that they celebrated?
I think it had to be.
Blu-ray. Yes. Ken Gampu was going to come out. For a small role.
But yeah, I mean, Michael DeLuca was in all that, like, underground comic shit and video games and Mortal Kombat. It's too bad there wasn't a Shaq Fu movie. They should have bought Mortal Kombat and Shaq Fu.
I think
that was probably pitched.
They need to have Happy Madison do that, you know, because Shaq's in all those movies anyway.
It could still happen. Shaq Fu could completely still happen.
I think they lost a lot of their creative decision-making when they fired DeLuca. Because I think he was the only one like with a touch to that world. I mean, I think Johnny Ray Gasca had a pitch meeting with Mike DeLuca.
Wow.
Yeah. You talk about a small world.
Yeah.
But they lost him, and they lost that type of... they lost that young mind they needed. You know, whether his decisions were good or bad, it's like... They needed that young mind who wanted to actually try all these things with these foreign directors or these young talents that had interesting ideas that they could be the first on the block to make a deal with them. And when they lost that, you could see how their decisions were just like, huh?
Well, it's like you said foreign directors, like, you know, the guy who did Spawn, Mark Dippy, he's from Japan.
Is he?
Yeah. I mean,
because I knew he's a special effects guy.
Well, and I, you know, to be fair, I think he's an army brat. You know, I think he's one.
Oh, okay. Well, the thing about him was, and this is the only real bone I have to pick with the movie is the acting is bad.
Super
to be
hammy.
Honest,
I think
everybody is acting like they're in a Batman episode. You know, the Adam West TV show. Because I think that's what Martin Sheen was thinking. Oh, this is like Batman.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, it's like. He's a special effects director, so I don't think he had any experience with actors. So that's probably the problem. Well, like, and D.B. Sweeney is just like a zombie in the whole film.
Well, I think one of the big problems with the movie is there is way too much John Leguizamo in it.
Yes.
Like, the Violator gets way too much screen time. And, you know, the look, the makeup, all the stuff they did for that character is bang on perfect. It is exactly what it needs to be. But having John Leguizamo carrying on in every scene tailing jokes, farting, you know, just constantly never shutting up, you know, popping up in these different costumes and making all these jokes and making Apocalypse Now jokes around Martin Sheen and stuff. It gets
it's just kind of real. Like, there was, it seemed like improv hour with like Zamo in costume.
It seemed and, like they, but, yeah, it seemed, but you know, doesn't it kind of seem like, and it also seems like too, there was this fascination with, we got this character's effect right, and it's almost like they didn't want to cut any of it too. I don't know, but
right, because it probably cost a lot, and it was probably a lot of effort to get him into the suit or whatever. And the
school thought at the time with boomers making these movies for children is that when you have the famous classically respected actor caked in the shit doing the children's movie as the talking cartoon villain,
yeah.
Let as much of that happen as possible, because the adults in the room usually think your hero, your leading man, is worthless and boring. And right. Pray that they really have a 90-minute stand-up thing that's secretly a costume drama. And, you know, I realize there's, you know, the clown shit is a little too much in Spawn, but I think that it maybe is not enough, because it's not quite 100 minutes. And I feel that if it was 100 minutes, the excess would be the right amount.
Well, what it really needed to get that to that 100 minutes was more scenes like when Spawn crashes into that dining room or that huge ballroom thing, and then they have that shootout and he kills the Jessica Priest character or whatever, and they have that was a good combination of CGI they had at the time with his cape, and it was almost like improving on the scene where Batman crashed through the ceiling in the 89 Batman on the Joker in the museum.
And there's that awesome shot where Michael High White backs up and the Spawn mask forms over his face. That scene, it still looks awesome today.
Like, yeah, there's some good action in there, like in the mix with the CGI that they were experimenting with, or you know.
Yeah, I mean, everything about the Spawn suit, the Spawn costume, the cape, the way the shit goes back up his face is perfect. And mind you, at the time in 97, they only had slippery, rubbery-looking CGI, and thankfully, that's all that was required for Spawn and his tendrils.
The CGI that has not aged well is the hell stuff, the male bullshit stuff.
Well, Bolger does look a little PlayStation 1-ish.
Oh, yeah. Very much like, oh, this is the cutscene in Final Fantasy VII, you know.
Yeah, to me, it looked like a CD-ROM game, because it was kind of my experience with that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the Frank Welker, you know, Mel Bolger thing is kind of adorable. That's the problem.
It really is. That's a great way to put it.
you just got to go in that Super Mario Brothers movie mentality and just accept it, because if you're supposed to, you know, be like, oh, this is the worst man, and like, no, it's I'm Frank Walker and I'm in my Frank Walker voice. It's, you know, it's stop the claw.
There's a certain mindset you have to have when you watch this Super Mario Brothers, Street Fighter, Double Dragon, you know, all this era of cinema, you know, you can't be wearing your Doug Walker hat and tie. You know, you're not Mr. Plinkett. You gotta be toyetic. You gotta be Joel Schumacher sitting there drinking it all in, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Spawn is completely Schumacherian in
yes.
way. I don't know if Spawn came out after Batman and Robin. So I don't know, people thought, and the criticism of the satanic shit was that Spawn was too dark, I guess, compared to Batman and Robin, which I suppose it is theoretically a darker thing than Batman and Robin, but Batman and Robin and Spawn are equally, they are of the same material in many ways.
Both highly toyetic, and, you know, does it get more toyetic than McFarlane, you know?
I mean, that everything in that movie is a tool.
Yes.
Which he conjures with his cape. His cape surrounds the motorcycle to turn it into the Swan cycle. Yes. Which is best. Because, I mean, it was going to be hard, I mean, to think about to have, like, Spawn doesn't have a vehicle. I mean, back in 93, 94, when they made the initial toyline, they added a Spawn van, a Spawn cycle, and a Spawn car. But none of these were canonical abilities in the Spawn arsenal. Spawn mainly would just use chains and, you know, and martial arts and machine guns. He would never drive or do anything. In fact, the Spawn comic, Spawn is kind of a passive character. Barely a superhero.
Well, the HBO animated series that followed this, or maybe it predated, I can't remember. He's very passive in that. It's like very passive anime type thing.
Yeah, they tried to... I think that after a year or so of being criticized... And, like, Wizard Magazine was very mean about Spawn. Like, they wanted Spawn to immediately have a remade, rebooted sequel with Eric Del Cell from ER and shit. They really had, like, these ideas that Spawn 97 wasn't representative of what they were seeing.
That's interesting you say that, because I do remember there was clamoring and promises of a meaner, tougher, R-rated reboot sequel when we didn't even use the word reboot for sequels.
Before they even made a Spider-Man movie. Yeah, this is an idea. Like, we're gonna get Spawn right, and we're gonna do it. It's gonna be like a dark, scary movie.
It's only gonna be midnight screenings and all this other shit.
Did the HBO cartoon come before or after this?
It came concurrently with the idea of making more. It came out 99-2000.
Okay.
And there's a lot of people are confused about the actual nature of it, because it was released on video as OVA cartoons, when in reality it was three seasons of a show that ended on something of a cliffhanger 20 years ago. And Todd, the Toddster, the Todd father, commissioned a fourth season with Keith David and all these people reprising their roles and all that shit. And it was made and animated, but it's never been shown or seen or released by anyone. It exists in limbo with so many signed baseballs. But yeah, the Spawn cartoon was an attempt to solidify Spawn's image as a serious, dark Avenger of the Night like Batman.
Yeah.
And as good as it was, the Spawn cartoon show, despite adapting the first five issues of Spawn in the first season of the show, isn't that much like the comic, because the comic is stupid pop and Toyota, and the cartoon show was almost pretentiously adult, grim, and nihilistic.
It was like trying to do the Batman the Animated Series for adults, kind of.
Which, unfortunately, only makes it more juvenile.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
That's the type of thing, like, you know, you would hire somebody like Josh Olson to write or something, you know, just like, nobody's gonna see it, nobody cares, you know.
Batman Gotham Knight.
That damn thing.
Gotham Knight.
Yeah.
That was, you know, that's a fine Batman cartoon. I'm a big fan of Josh Olson and his writing, by the way. He's a... But yeah, the Spawn HBO animated series is a very good rep from adults who like late night porn and shit. But it's it's not Spawn.
They weren't in the mood to watch Andy Sedaris movies or Goodbye Emmanuel. They're gonna watch Spawn.
And then, like, it had these fake Rod Serling intros. See, I don't think they have them on the DVDs. They have it on Amazon, but not on the DVDs that they were. Hopefully, the AT&T lovingly has Warner MPI remaster each episode of Spawn specifically for me, so I can have it and talk about how great it is, but how inferior it is to Mark A.Z. DePay's Spawn movie from 97.
Yeah, and you can watch that on HBO Max, the Spawn cartoon.
Is it on there? Yeah. Well, I guess I'll revisit those to see what the hell they were like, because I don't remember liking them all that much.
Three seasons on HBO Max.
Jeez.
The first season ends so perfectly that they should never have made any more. But it's basically Spawn turned into the Crow a little bit, because they up the tragic Phantom of the Opera shit to the most extreme level.
Why hasn't Andrew Lloyd Webber done a Spawn musical?
Because I think Spawn involves African Americans.
And none of them are named Judas.
Weber's Broadway demo, and the Spawn Army, I don't think coalesce.
They don't cross over,
But maybe I think that there are quite a few Spawn fans who like the Dwight Little, Robert Englund fan of the Opera. I mean, I like that one. That's my favorite. Yeah. But maybe they can like bridge that into appreciating, theater or whatever in a post-theater world.
Well, let me add. Speaking of music, let's talk about current events. Okay, so Todd McFarlane, the Todd Father, did a lot of work and with the band called Iced Earth that did a Spawn concept record.
Yes. Right?
And apparently the mind, the brains behind Iced Earth, John Schaefer, was just participated in the riot at the Capitol building in January. And
that is legally trepidatious activity.
And he accepted a deal to go into witness protection the other day.
A disguise, John Schaefer?
Yeah, so I don't know. Does this mean Iced Earth is done? Are we going to get no more Spawn heavy metal albums?
I mean, if Cat Stevens can do it, I think.
Yeah, I just got to change the name.
that's too. They're actually. Isn't there another Spawn concept album, from McFarlane's period, when he wanted to be the main plastic Kiss person?
So McFarlane, didn't he do some stuff for Kiss, like Psycho Circus comics or something? Or am I thinking of someone else?
They exist, but I've never actually looked in one. I've never physically opened one and allowed the images to invade my mind. But yes, he did. In 98 through 99, there was so much Kiss and also fake. He also bought the rights to the Crow very briefly and had his own Crow comic under Image, which is really just him. But yes, there was Kiss Psycho Circuit. There was, Todd McFarlane did album covers as well as a whole comic series for Kiss during that time, as well as a video game to go along with their tour line.
I think Mike Baron wrote some of those Kiss comics.
Really?
I know he said that working for Gene Simmons was tougher than working for Lucasfilms. He said the list of demands that he had to live up to and stick by when he was writing them was crazy. He said it was way easier to write Star Wars comics for Lucasfilms than Dark Horse.
Listen, the Star Child, the Star Child and I are the only characters that matter. If you give the Space Ace or the Catman any more
that's
time
probably what it was.
Than
I
me
bet
or
you
the Star Child, I will come over there and I will castrate you. Do you understand me, Mike?
Star Child cannot be. Isn't he the demon? I forget which.
Paul, here's the thing: like in the Kiss camp, it's Gene and Paul versus everyone else. Like the Star Child is Paul, Gene is the demon.
Yes.
You know, but the but Ace, they have this vendetta against Ace and Peter, and like erasing them from history. Basically.
Yeah, it's kind of grotesque.
Well, that is the unfortunate thing about having branded identities and painted faces, is that you can be Phantom of the Parked, just like that.
Yep.
Well, I mean, not just like that, but pretty close.
Yeah. But I don't know. I'm looking up Spawn concept albums, and The Dark Saga by Iced Earth is the one that keeps coming up.
But, I mean, there's the one for the movie, and there's I'm probably confused about the Kiss shit from there anyway, because it all blends together. Also, two Robs, because remember before there was like NECA, Todd McFarlane was NECA, mm-hmm. essentially, so he made all the Rob Zombie, Ozzy Osbourne, action figures in the late '90s. So he sort of had a market on metal paraphernalia.
Yeah,
and with Todd McFarlane shit, it's hard to know when it's actually Todd and not someone else ghostwriting. Because,
he's the Godfather. Yeah,
he leads from behind.
Yeah,
is a good example.
Well, he's like male Bulger,
Yes, exactly, like male Bulger. except he means well. He wants for everyone.
Well, there's a if anybody wants to look up a fast, I think you can find this online. There was an interview the Comics Journal did with Todd McFarlane in the early '90s when Spawn was this big thing, and it was basically just Todd McFarlane arguing with Gary Groth, and Gary Groth is a pretentious liberal like you wouldn't believe, and they had such disagreements about what the comic industry should be. It was hilarious because Todd was actually right on every account. And basically just killed him in the argument. Like, Todd, I think he said things to just troll him, like, oh, I never read any books. I just read the sports pages. No writers influence me.
It's like Woody Allen. Oh, I only watch
basketball. Yeah, exactly.
I like to drink beer and watch basketball. I don't really like to go to art house movies. I don't know where you get this idea that I read the New York Times and eat bagels and go to plays. I like basketball and I like beer.
When Alan saying he doesn't read was hysterical because I haven't read since comic books when I was a kid. I don't read books.
Well, I mean, that is the whole point of being Rob and Todd is to be the best and to remind people asking that they aren't and they won't be.
Yes.
And despite, people like to laugh and shit, Rob and Todd, specifically Todd McFarlane and Rob Liefeld, exclusively, have yet to be wrong about anything. Even their bad ideas were just too early.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, when Image, not Image, or Malibu, whoever, took over half of Marvel in 96, 97 to write Fantastic Four and reboot all that shit, it was hated, but 4 years later, with the Ultimates Comics Initiative, which was the same shit, it basically saved the printing division at Marvel Entertainment overnight. So all their scary Martin Luther-esque things were correct. Completely.
And are they kind of political pariahs in comics?
I mean, I have to assume so. I don't know what their politics is. And I know that the Todd Fallon is Canadian, so he has, unfortunately, no politics at all because Canada, there's no, the Canadian, there's no whatever.
They're kind of a mono hive mind up there.
Well, I was just thinking about, Liefeld and McFarlane, and then there's the connection with Schaefer, who's a pretty right-wing guy, which has gotten him in trouble, legal trouble recently.
Well, I mean, this is going to sound kind of weird, but like the only, they, if you're a guy, they don't really care. Mm-hmm. They don't get, you get like a pass as long as you don't like show like apologetic weakness.
Right.
And you know, as long as the Funko loving masses love Deadpool and say Deadpool is my spirit animal, you know, assuming Rob Liefeld doesn't like, you know, try to go to Texas and make it secede, I think he'll be okay.
Well, that was Schaefer's mistake, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you gotta be chill. You gotta, yeah, not,
you can't freak out. You can't go try to steal Nancy Pelosi's podium.
And not, you gotta be nice. You gotta hold doors for people. You gotta not touch surfaces. And you gotta wear a mask and be a good boy. It's that simple. I'm an aggressively obedient good boy. I protect and defend and cherish the boat.
I think that's a good message. Good message.
Yeah, I mean, assuming Rob Liefeld and Todd McFarlane will be great as long as they can generate hype, or people remember they exist.
So is the Todd father still big in toys? You mentioned Walking Dead and Batman earlier. Because when I think of toys, yeah, toys has been they've been taken over. Funko Pops have just taken over everything.
Well, Funko Pops. I don't mean to be callous. Funko Pops, I see as a long-term terminal illness in the toy industry, and that's like, you know, that's like nuclear midnight, and that's when it's all Funko Pops. That is our nuclear toy midnight. Is when it's simply Funko garbage. As of right now, the toy aisle still has Hasbro and McFarlane figures, and the reason why I mention McFarlane figures in the toy aisle is because the Todd father got the rights to all the DC Comics toys. Because DC Comics is having existential problems as of late. As in, they don't really exist anymore. Mm. So he has complete DC Comics multiverse license, which up until very recently, he was completely squandered and wasted by making grotesquely ugly, zombified Batman and Superman figures that nobody wants.
That's too bad, because I would think of Batman, because the McFarlane toys I remember, the ones that I have, are pretty sweet.
They were well created, and they were sculpted by some of the best, like Kyle Wedricks and who's the other one? I feel horrible for getting the other sculptor. But yeah, Claiborne Moore, all those people. They still do work for them, and the Walking Dead stuff they make is still pretty high level. But you can see they've lost a lot of ground to NECA and Mezco, because over the last decade or so, McFarlane mainly focused on sports figures until the Walking Dead became ever present, and the DC Comics license is less than a year old. It's a brand new thing. And the main reason, I think, why McFarlane has chosen such ugly Batman and Superman toys to make as of this right now is because it reflects what's going on contemporarily in the comics that were published or are published or were published as of last February. Mm. Because Batman isn't regularly published anymore. Much other titles, so it's kind of like, oh, which, as I said, DC Comics is either going to be born to new greatness or die completely.
So the Spawn film, what do we think I think we've touched on effects this may have had on movies and comics and culture, like the use of CGI. But it was, you know, was it because of politics at New Line that this franchise didn't go anywhere? They talked about rebooting it. What happened exactly?
I don't know. I know that the adult fanboys of the time, these are the same people who would find issue with Phantom Menace a year later. They just felt that it wasn't totally cool, edgy, and radical like the Spawn comics they read 4 years ago when they were they were probably in high school. Well, these people were in high school. Mm-hmm. But they don't realize that the Spawn comics from 92 and 93 were toyetic and stupid, with the exception of Billy Kincaid, you know, child murderer, pedophile subplot. It's all, you know, like Silver Age stupidity with like a dash of attempted Frank Miller pop cultural social consciousness.
And the thing is, that's so... Yeah, I mean, there are those subplots in the comics, because I read those comics back in the day. But when I watch this film, it captures the aesthetics. It captures the spirit of it, which is, frankly, kind of stupid and over the top, but it's fun. I like Martin Sheen as Jason Wynn. He's doing the Batman, the TV series thing, and I think it's great.
Yeah, he's evil Martin Sheen thing. Same like in the Jodie Foster movie, where he's the little girl lives down the lane. He does the evil Estevez voice.
Yes, yeah. yes.
Yeah, he's evil pedophile in that, and he's evil mass killer in this. Works for the government.
Yeah, it's like they're like, Martin Sheen, play a government bad guy. Ah, so I'm playing a Republican.
Yeah, exactly.
Give me that.
He's
cigar.
Doing a Rush Limbaugh voice. Rush Limbaugh voice, totally.
Like he calls all the people ditto heads as he blows them up. You know.
Yes.
Well, I mean, I'm always a big defender of using tropes, even if they're crass and low, because they respond to things that they recognize.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But you know, the vibe
is.
You do have those things from the time, like you have to have the kid character for the kids in the audience to identify with. You have Miko Hughes playing that homeless kid. You've got the dog, which, by the way, I think it's hilarious that the family's out with the dog. They're like, oh, Spaz can find his way home by himself.
Us. Like, yeah, that's a really weird line to keep in.
It's very strange.
Like they'd be like, you know, where's the dog? I don't know. But I mean, maybe they. I know that the production of Spawn was perilous in many ways, and you don't really hear anything about it because all the commentary and stuff is from people who didn't make the movie. So, like, you know, Todd McFarlane's commentary is, you know, he was a cameo in the movie, but like, I think that, you know. Frank McElroy and Steve Williams and all these people, they did it, and you know, and I think Tom McFarlane was proud of the movie until Wizard didn't like it, and then he was like, it sucked and it wasn't what I wanted. But I'm fairly sure it is what he wanted.
Isn't it amazing how the media can influence what you think about something?
Yeah. And this is before, and remember back then, you know, the media was not forced to say good things about movies, superhero movies for children. They were still, you know, they still had criticisms of the pageants of commercial culture, and they were like in that way, like they were very like the same criticisms that were levied against Batman and Robin were actually levied against Spawn in parts. Because it wasn't just the campiness of Batman and Robin that bothered them; it was the toyetic stupidity.
Yeah.
So I mean, at the end of the day, you have one thing that's, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, I guess. But Tom McFarlane really should have stuck to his guns, and just accepted the Spawn movie for what it was, as the ultimate expression of his will at that time. And if people didn't like it, and I guarantee the demo that it was made for liked it. I mean, I liked it. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like it's the greatest thing ever made. But it's...
I thought it was cool. You know, and then when I got a little older, I got a little cynical and I watched it and I went, oh, you know, these effects don't hold up. Oh, it's not as good. But watching it the other day, I had a blast. I loved watching it. And I've gotten a little more to where I've accepted these 90s things for all they are, you know, like, you know, they aren't perfect for what, you know, whatever fan sort of thing you want, but culturally they just made sense at the time, I guess. And Spawn really, I think, pushed kind of it was an experimental movie. It tried a lot of new things. It was edgy, you know. And watching it in the context at the time, I think it makes sense.
Yeah, it reflects the zeitgeist of that time. And the ultimate thing against its probably its staying power is that Spawn is not a big deal in the way that the ever-present big two corporate superheroes are.
Right.
Very few of the Marvel characters are important, but characters like Spider-Man will be ever-present in ways that Spawn can't be. Spawn is very much a product of the 90s.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, eventually, Spawn will stop being published. I mean, because it's only really Todd's vanity project, and I don't see like someone else taking over Spawn, like, you know, after 400 issues, like, I'm going to continue Spawn.
Well, when you talk to teenagers today, they don't know what Spawn is. You know, the only ones who know what Spawn is are the ones who watch millennials on YouTube who talk about Spawn, you know?
Yeah, Spawn is forgotten, almost completely forgotten.
Like, the only people who know Spawn are, you know, Zoomers don't know Spawn. Millennials know Spawn, but it has not translated. It has not lasted to the younger generation the way Spider-Man and the Marvel and DC stuff has.
Spawn is probably less known than Judge Dredd, even, probably.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Judge Dredd at least has had a movie recently, you know.
And it's two movies. It's been around for almost 50 years.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole British comic thing is slightly more respectable than the 90s Dark Age thing. Yep. But, I mean, it's all the same in the end. I will argue that the Stallone movie is the correct Judge Dredd, because Judge Dredd is supposed to be funny.
Yeah, you know, when you watch the Stallone one, the only real problem is he takes off his helmet for most of it. But if you just forget about that, I mean, the Judge Dredd comics are silly. They're really goofy. Well,
the Spawn movie makes the same helmet problem. In Spawn, the comic, Spawn always has his Spawn mask. So he can look like a perfect Spider-Man Venom hybrid. So if you're not really sure, you at least know, oh, buy that thing. But yeah, the fact that Spawn is unmasked at the whole movie, that was just a conventional wisdom thing.
Yeah.
And the guy. So Stallone, and, well, the problem with Michael J. White is that his unmasked mask was still a mask.
Yeah, that's the thing that didn't make sense, because, you know, either way, Michael High White was going to be buried under makeup. You know, but at the end of the day, when you're a director, movies, the facial expressions of your actors communicate so much. That's why Sam Raimi's going to have Spider-Man get his mask ripped up so we can see Tobey Maguire's face. You know, there's something about it's, and I even heard John Letts talk about this, the guy who did the recent Marvel Spider-Man movies that I haven't bothered with, but
yeah, I don't.
He said, but there was an interview where he said that, you know, he had the eyes of the mask move so that you could at least get some emotion out of it. Because just having a mask, there's nothing there. And with Judge Dredd, I think the what's his name? The guy who wrote 28 Days Later, who wrote Dredd. What's his name?
Alex Garland.
Alex Garland. His Dredd movie, I think, did a great job because you could see his mouth. Really, you can communicate so much with that. But I think with the Stallone one, there was this worry that if we have his helmet on, we've got Sly. We're paying for Sly. We want to see Sly, right?
Yeah.
And so with Carl Urban, you know, Carl Urban's kind of a more of a generic guy. So you can kind of get away with putting the helmet on him. But he did a great job of communicating whatever was going on. But Judge Dredd just has to look pissed off all the time. That's all he has to look like.
But also Dredd has almost no humor. It's an almost humorless dystopian movie, which threw me off when I went to see it because I know the character better from the comics than anything else. And the
futuristic element isn't even that futuristic. And
yeah, it's not.
No, it's South African
apartment building.
Which is why I give it a big film Twitter thumbs down because, like, number one, it's not in the future and it's not funny. And, I mean, at the end of the day, we know what Carl Urban looks like and we know what Stallone looks like. So whether or not Judge Dredd's actor is masked or unmasked, the whole pageantry of the face of Joseph Dredd is kind of nullified either way. It's like, you know, computers don't beep in real life.
When I saw
that is kind of a spoiler, isn't it? I mean, you think about it. I mean, I was a kid when Judge Dredd came out. So I mean, the first one. I mean,
yeah.
I was grown up. 2012 movie came out, but I mean that kind of thinking about that kind of gymnastics, like if you see Judge Dredd's face, if you know what the guy playing Judge Dredd looks like, then it'll go. But like the plot of Judge Dredd, the original movie, is way better because he like has to team up with Rob Schneider and like learn to lighten up and shit, and that's like good.
And you got him Ron DeSante
as Judge Dredd. It's every movie, every piece of shit with costumes and Max von Sydow is good.
Yes, I agree.
That means The Force Awakens, Star Wars is also good.
Well, listen, that's why we liked it for a little bit when it came out, because it had costumes and Max von Sydow. The movie opens with Max von Sydow, and you go, how could this be bad? It's Max von Sydow.
Yeah, I know. It's been 5 years in a lockdown and fifth Metal Gear Solid's. A lot of water under that bridge. But yeah, movie costumes and Max von Sydow. So, I mean, that's like, gets you in the mood for cinema.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I like the violence of 2012 Dredd, but there's no real good humoristic discussion of the endless cycle of punitivity.
We need a 90s toyetic Dredd with Judge Death.
There's no Carl Urban action figure. There were action figures of the Stallone movie.
Yeah.
That's how
there was also a Sega Genesis video game, which I have, you know.
Yes, and a Game Boy and a GameCube.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need a new Judge Dredd movie where he's like giving couples tickets for kissing in public.
Also, yeah. I'm gonna throw down. Danny Cannon is better than Alex Garland.
Danny Cannon unfairly thrown into director's ISO cube over that movie. You know?
Well, he created CSI, the format for that. He basically created the entire directorial style for the CSI shows.
He dwarfs Alex Garland and Edgar Wright. Their contributions to zombieism are meaningless. He's the real deal. His Judge Dredd, his sequel to I Know What You Did Last Summer, and, you know, he was the first person to make a pilot for the Gotham TV show. So he is as influential as Steve Miner, if not more.
Mm. We got the hottest takes here, guys.
Danny Cannon is like a cool name.
Yeah, his name's how can you not respect a man on the set who's the director, whose name is Danny Cannon.
That's like a very respectable name.
He should have directed like the last Dirty Harry film or something.
Yeah. They
like the Milius script for the Dirty Harry teaching at the Seattle University.
Well, that's when we talk back about The Rookie. I think The Rookie and Bloodwork and Gran Torino were all attempted sixth Dirty Harrys.
Oh yeah,
it's not hard to imagine like watching those and thinking, oh, this probably started as a Dirty Harry script. Or in the case of Bloodwork, they could have just bought the rights and then turned it into a Dirty Harry script.
Well, because, I mean, he's playing the Dirty Harry character, basically.
Yeah.
But Bloodwork is maybe a little too grim and psychosexual for the whole the Dirty Harry. Well, yeah, but Dirty Harry has that horror element that the Gallo people on the internet like talk about. It does have that. But I think of it as strictly as a straightforward action movie where structures fail and tries to do justice.
Yeah, it takes this Archie Bunker style bigoted cop to take down the menace.
Yeah.
Like he's your last hope.
He only is the only thing that'll save you. Save the innocent children, the school bus.
Right. Government can't save you. The church can't save you, but Dirty Harry can.
Well, yeah, Carl Urban was doing an Eastwood impression for the judge.
Yeah, definitely. He's not doing his New Zealand voice.
Eastwood is responsible for Wolverine and Judge Dredd and a lot of two-dimensional would-be action figures.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. 2000 AD guys did admit they said Judge Dredd was basically Dirty Harry in the future.
Now, do we talk about the fact that originally Judge Dredd was black?
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah, no, they changed it. They did. I mean, in the way that Smithers was. Like, in early installment, you know, kind of. Mm. Well, I mean, it's originally, maybe Judge Dredd was supposed to, was given black features. That's some like art school trivia argument stuff, but it is there. Like, if you want to go, you know, full snit on somebody, you can be like, "Yeah, Judge Dredd was originally black."
Interesting.
Are they ever going to publish like definitive omnibuses of Judge Dredd, like in color and?
I've just seen the black and white ones.
Yeah, I don't have interest in them because I like that stuff in color. So.
I think Richard Stanley has to win more wizard battles before 2000. Hardcover archival editions in the colonies.
Because I know they did a satire story arc on McDonald's that they could not reprint.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that they cannot. And like DC and Dark Horse over the decades have licensed Judge Dredd simply to keep the British shit out of America.
Right. Now we figured that.
That the big two fear so terrible.
Because I have some of those Baxter reprints they did for Eagle Comics in the 80s, and that stuff is fantastic. But and you can find it in a lot of dollar bins still to this day.
Oh, dollar bins are the only comic stores that exist. In the future, we'll have the finest dollar bins.
Ever. Yes, I agree. I totally agree. I find all my best reads there.
Yeah.
Well, guys, do we want to go ahead and rate Spawn 1997?
I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10 because I'm 11 years old and can't be too hard on something from the era of innocent purity like that. You know, how hard can you be on a nice dream?
Exactly. I think that's a great take. John, what about you?
I give it like a 6.5, and probably due to the fact I watched that ugly HD print on Roku, on the Roku channel. But
that is ways.
But also the acting got on my nerves a bit. And because I'd forgotten the movie for the most part, except for that action scene in the ballroom I thought that was really well edited and staged and everything. You didn't see a lot of stuff staged like that in movies at the time.
I liked that, and I liked the fight scene. Any fight scene with where John Leguizamo turns into Demon Violator, I thought was awesome.
Yeah, those were decent. Those held up okay. So it's got a lot of benefits. You could see where there's room for improvement, but a lot of it, I think, is due to the fact that the director had very little experience with actors and real filmmaking. Just, you know, he's a special effects guy. And this is kind of where everything looked like it was going in the 90s, was these special effects guys were going to take over movies and direct all the big action superhero stuff.
Well, it's what George Lucas would have wanted, you know.
Right, right. And, you know, last week I rewatched Batman Returns, and I was kind of struck at how well handled the acting was. And I think Tim Burton has a skill with actors, particularly big names, that probably could have been used in some of these lower budgeted, you know, by those standards, superhero films.
Yeah, I think the actors are kind of just doing their own thing in this movie. You get the feeling that Martin Sheen's doing the 60s Batman TV show villain. Michael High White is just doing his action thing. John Leguizamo is doing stand-up. D.B. Sweeney does not seem to be acting at all.
I don't think he's there. I think he's physically there. I just don't think he's really there.
He's just acting. He's just delivering his lines. Miko Hughes is just being a kid. You know, it's all, they do not, the actors don't feel like they have a lot of direction, but it doesn't bother me that much because it is such a visual movie. To me, it is such a 90s. It is a great representation of comics in the 90s where it's all style over substance. And it's pretty cool. And I also think the cinematography by Guillermo Navarro is pretty good. He's a really good cinematographer, and I think he elevates a lot of the films by directors who are really overrated, like Guillermo del Toro. And in this movie, he makes it look quite good. But yeah, I give it a 7 out of 10. I think it's, you know, it just, it really, 1997 right here. I like to watch this movie and music video tie-ins and the EPK press kit. It just, it takes me back.
I would agree with Zolly on one thing. If Todd McFarlane had just ignored the opinions and just said, hey, we're going to make a sequel. I liked it, but we can make a bigger, better sequel. I think.
Yeah.
That's all he had to say, and he probably would have had one.
Well, and here's the thing, too, is when you, the creator, take a crap on your movie, you're admitting it's bad. Well, okay, then why do we need to make another one if it's bad? You know, people didn't like it. Well, now it's a bigger risk because we made a bad movie already.
I mean, Rob Liefeld is smart in the way. I'm going to kind of say something that might be controversial and shocking. The Deadpool movies are not representative of Deadpool at all.
No,
I mean,
Ryan Reynolds' Deadpool is what it is.
They're representative of Deadpool as it exists for the last 20 years. But if Rob Liefeld's saying this Deadpool is represented the way he imagined, that is a complete lie. Deadpool was envisioned as a serious, badass Marvel version of Deathstroke, who was only funny in the way that, like, you know, all the other extremely 90s edgy characters were funny. The whole, you know, Deadpool is comic relief thing didn't happen until sometime, you know, 97, 98, 99, when he became a worthless C-list X-Men punching bag that nobody cared about. I mean, that's Rob Liefeld basically agreeing with Deadpool as a joke and making a business out of it. That's like no shame. At least Todd McFarlane has the rage based resent to try to continue the assault, which is cool. I respect that single minded antagonism towards Marvel and DC that ceases to stop, you know, juggernauting towards stuff.
Yes. 100%. All right, guys. Well, I think that's a good spot to end it.
So, it's, you know, I'm waiting for the bombs to drop.
You listen to Martin Sheen's character in Spawn and you go, yes, please, when? All right, guys. Yeah, it's great having you back on, Zolly. Always love Cape Shit commentary, Zolly.
We should subtitle the episodes with Zolly Cape Shit commentary.
Yeah. All right, John, anything to plug?
Other than Stu's views, Stu's been cranking them out. He put two in a row out as of this recording in the last 48 hours. So, be sure to check the website for those. And, favorite new Twitter page, Fat Dave Smith on Twitter. If you're a fan of Dave Smith, the libertarian comedian, this is a pretty funny satire of his page that I think he endorses it. It's been cracking me up for the last couple of days. But if you're not a fan of Dave Smith, you're not going to get the joke at all. Yeah. So
I'm going to go follow Dave Smith.
It's cracking me up. It's cracking me up as Sean Zubox and Richard Juice and Low Res frequently do on Twitter. So,
Zolly, anything you want to mention before we go?
Oh, no, just, general peace and good wishes and positivity towards everyone in my field and my periphery.
Very wholesome. Love it.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, with that, I'm going to say adios.
Thank you.
Peace out.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.